All right, everyone, welcome back. This is episode 19 of Christian History and Ideas. I'm John Coleman here from Connecticut, and joining me from the snowy north, I suspect, Dr. Nirmal Das.
Yes, indeed snowy.
Well, it's snowy here too. As we enter the second part of Advent in our recording, the date that we're recording, the 17th, we're being pelted down here in New England with a big old storm. So it's good to meet here, Dr. Das, and to take my mind off the shoveling and this sort of thing.
Great to be here, John.
Great. We're going to talk of all things as we are approaching Christmas tide and this season, this cultural season, this religious season, and getting our minds in that spirit and so forth. We're actually going to take you, and we ourselves are going to travel in this episode and the next episode 20 to China. We're going to talk about the Catholic population in China, particularly in far Western China, in Tibet. And you don't have to do a double take there. Yes, we did say that there is a Catholic church in Tibet and it's been there for a long stretch. And we're going to talk about that and all sorts of related topics. This particular village, mind you, which we'll read a news story shortly, is notable because of its Christmas festivities of all things. So many topics there. The only starting announcements, and we'll reprise these at the end, is any correspondence or any suggestions and so forth. You may write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. And we'll have all other sorts of information, but let's clear the decks here. And Dr. Das, I think we should begin with possibly a mention of China in the Holy Bible.
Yes, let's start with that. That would be interesting.
All right. So this is from the very appropriate Advent figure, Isaiah. This is from Isaiah 49 and verse 12. 49:12. See, these shall come from afar, some from the north and the west, and others from the land of Syene. And that's spelled in this translation, S-Y-E-N-E. So with that, once again, I'll recite it. See, these shall come from the far, some from the north and west, and others from the land of Syene. With that, Dr. Das, let's take it away. We'll set this up and then we'll get into some maps and things.
Sure, yes. So Syene is probably, likely, the classical term for China, Sunai. Of course, the world of China, as we know it, was known to the Greeks and the Romans, or the Western world, as the Chinese would call it. So now we should start maybe using their terminology as opposed to ours. So the Chinese are aware of the West and the lands to the West. And there is a lot of history of communication between the Greeks and the Romans and so forth. And this will lead us into, you know, the Christian period as well as we get into it. So China is not unknown, and the West is not unknown to China. There is contact, there is connections, and we'll talk about a very important thing, which is the development of the Silk Road, which is going to be the main artery of communication. And there are other roads too that were Roman and Greek and so forth. The chief among these is a little mentioned river, but a very important river, and that's the Oxus River, O-X-U-S. Very, very important river in world history, actually, in Central Asia. It's in Central Asia, and it cuts right across. So these are the arteries, the communication highways of the time, which allowed China and the West to rather easily communicate and interact for commerce and, of course, ideas and so forth. So the two, we may assume that the two are separate, or they're self-enclosed and all this sort of thing. But they weren't. There was a lot of dynamism here. There's a lot of dynamic communication and contact going on. And we have a lot of history of that, actually. And this contact goes really, really far back. And we can, you know, look at that some other time. But for us, it's quite interesting that these roads of communication allow the context to happen and do what happens and what you know comes about in our story as we.
And I should say on the screen here, this is a type of digital representation of the river. And yes. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Das, but this large body of water to the left of the screen is the Black Sea.
It's the Black Sea, yes.
Correct. Yeah.
So, and this, of course, links it up with Greece and Rome and the Mediterranean and all that. So you can see how easy it is to access Central Asia and right into China through this river. And some say that this is probably the route also that the early Greeks took into India in the 6th century and so forth. It's a very interesting river, very little known, unfortunately. And some historians even think that it's this river that Alexander the Great took into his, you know, conquest of the East that way. So very important river that connects all of Central Asia and takes us right into the borders of China.
Right. Yeah, we often forget that the Romans were up in Armenia and they had access all around the Black Sea. If they had their way, they would have encompassed the Black Sea because it let them get trade up into Russia and things. We don't think of that being a front of, you know, the Russian Empire, but they were very much thinking that.
Of course, and don't forget there were other roads. There's the Amber Road, there's the Fur Road, Siberian Road. So, you know, these we in our own, you know, I guess in our own worldview, we think these are all cut off and no one knew each other. And no, the world was quite dynamic, just like today. People knew each other, knew about each other. And so, and of course there was a great deal of curiosity. So there were other roads of communication and yes, you're right. The Romans never really got around to doing all that. They probably would have, you know, but other things happened to them. So it's a very important area for history, Central Asia and China. And the point is that it's not isolated, it's not cut off. It's open to everything that's going on in the West.
Indeed. In class here at Apakus de Stasis the other day, we had a discussion about the possible influences. We talk about contact of East and West, of Buddhism on Stoicism, on certain conclusions there. So, yeah, there's that interaction there.
We'll talk about that as we get into the history of Christianity in China, because Buddhism is going to play an interesting role in all of this sort of thing. But it's going to be surprising for people. It's not going to be the usual where, you know, oh, Buddhists influence Christianity. No, it's probably the other way around.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that, you know, later.
Good morsel there. Yeah. But before we get to that morsel, let's just to orient ourselves with the topic here. I thought it would be good to, first of all, bring up a map of China. And in particular of Tibet, which is a special focus of our time today. And once that is done, just a quick snippet about the congregation in China. I think that'll orient ourselves very well. So here is a map, everyone, of modern China with all of the provinces and so forth. Of course, the coastal areas are where the massive amounts of population reside. But our area here that we're looking at is Tibet. I know the cursor can be seen and recorded here, so I'm circling Tibet here in the far west, right, running right up against India and this sort of thing down here in the lower left. And above it, we have Xinjiang, which has been in the news for the past couple of years, right? So these are contested areas as far as the residents there are concerned, as far as the Chinese Communist Party is concerned, they are part of China. So there's some present tension there. Xinjiang is notable lately because of the concentration camps with particularly many hundreds of thousands of Muslims there. And then Tibet, I think in our Western press, is not notable for Catholics by any means, except for one story we'll bring up, about the Christmas celebration, but mostly because of the tension of the Buddhists in Tibet with the CCP.
Right. And also, John, if you wouldn't mind pointing out to people Mongolia, which is up on the top there.
There we go. Here we go. Inner Mongolia. And
because that's going to be playing a very important, role in our story as well. So just to orient ourselves.
Okay. And this is this area here in Irmao with my cursor.
That's
okay.
Right.
Excellent. Right. Just as a little vignette, I throw these in when appropriate. When I was working in the library, maybe 10 years ago in college, we had a lady from China. She had grown up in the southeastern area where the big cities are and things. Had come through the education system and so forth. And we used to at lunchtime look at the globe and talk about things. And one day, one of the other librarians just happened to point out, I believe it was Tibet. And she just said, without thinking about it, that's where all the terrorists live. And I thought, wow, just the her education work from the CCP, it was really interesting, just off the cuff dismissal there.
Interesting, very interesting.
Anyway, so we'll get into controversies maybe in our talk here, but here's our map. We have our Mongolia up here in the north, then our Xinjiang, and then especially for us, our Tibet down here in the lower left. Nirmal, I'd like to switch to just a quick blurb about the Christmas celebration.
Sure, yes.
And throw it back to you there. All right. Here we go. There we go. Okay. Please note that this happens to appear and on a website called exploretibet.com, which is a tourist website, which is very important for certain cultural points we'll be bringing up probably in our next episode. But anyway, the title here from exploretibet.com is "The Only Catholic Church in Tibet." When mentioned, Tibetan religion, Lama religion with dense nationality, color, and its mysterious atmosphere will appear in mind. It's a horrible beginning sentence. Shame on the editor. That's very clunky. Okay, but okay, the traditional Lama religion, the Buddhism and so forth will appear in mind, giving you the feeling of mystery and dignity. Most Tibetans believe in Buddhism, but there is a small village in Yingjiang in Naxi ethnic group township of Markham County under Kamdo Prefecture in southwest China's Tibet Autonomous Region, where 90% of the villagers of this town believe in Catholicism. And it describes the Chinese Christmas festival there, which is a melding of various points that we can bring up. But now that we know our map, Nirmal, and we have a little bit of a orientation there, let me throw it back to you.
Okay, great. And also Tibet, we should, we'll look at that as well. It's not surprising that there is still one church left, but there was a time when there were quite a few churches in Tibet because Tibet was largely Christian, but that's going to be later on in our story. So we shouldn't, jump ahead. So what I thought I would do very quickly is to give a context to Christianity in China, because often we think of Christianity in our own day and age, in 2020 and 21 and beyond, but it's a faith that is rooted very deeply in China, and it's very old and ancient in China, and likely more ancient than Buddhism in China. So the point is, how old is Christianity in China? I mean, that's the basic question we should ask. Now, there are certain kinds of traditions which point to Saint Thomas, who is, of course, Christ's disciple, who we know went to India and evangelized there. And there are also traditions that he traveled from India into China. And he did this sometime in 64 AD, 64 to 87 AD is what people are suggesting, or historians. This stuff is very new, this kind of study into ancient history of Christianity in China. And it's only recently that newer things are being looked at, new archaeological evidence is coming out. And if you wouldn't mind bringing up the frieze that we talked about, John,
yes,
at the Lianyonggang frieze, which is very interesting. And it's one of the latest ones that has been brought up. Not this one, but the other one, the first one you just had, John. There we go. That's the one. It's a cover of a book in French by a very interesting French historian, Pierre Perrier. There's others. Good. So the interesting thing about this frieze is that it seems to depict Christ, the Virgin Mary, and various scenes from Jesus's life. And of course, there are all kinds of, discussions, controversies. Some say it's not as old. Some say it's Buddhist. So there's a lot of give and take right now among scholars. But for the majority of the scholars that are looking at this, and Pierre Perrier is one of them, he's suggesting that we're already actually looking at a very ancient and very early Christian frieze. And frieze is, of course, carving on a rock, on stone. There's a very ancient and early Christian frieze in China, and he's located various Christian elements in that. Unfortunately, I don't think we can access too much of those images on Google. We tried, but it's unfortunately not available. So perhaps what I should do is maybe scan the book sometime, and we can talk more about this.
Absolutely.
St. Thomas's mission into China. It's fascinating stuff. So there's a lot of this stuff, archaeological stuff, I should say, that is now being looked at anew and maybe discovered. So the story is slowly being pushed back of Christianity in China. So it's not a new phenomenon at all in China. And as we will look at in the story of China, Christianity is going to play some very key roles in the development and history of Chinese civilization. So I would like to begin there. So, we have the various earliest records of Chinese connection to Christianity through one of the most, through a direct link to Jesus himself, which is St. Thomas. So it's likely, if this is all going to be proven to be true as the studies continue, then it's likely we can conclude that Christianity was brought to China by St. Thomas himself, as it was brought to India, farther to the south. So it's a very important little, starting point for us. So this takes us into the first century, and we know there are connections with the Romans and the Hellenic world for the Chinese. So it's not going to be anything new. But if we were to ask, when specifically do we have more concrete evidence, comes about 400 years later on, because we know around, 537 or so, we have one of the first Christian missionaries by the name of Mar Sergis, Sergius, who goes to China and sets up missionary work there, and of course makes a lot of converts. Around 537 AD, 1500 years ago almost, we are looking at a very strong Christian presence. And by strong, I mean we have the establishment of churches and monasteries, which of course means there's a population to sustain that kind of structures, those kinds of structures, if we just look at it that way. China is encountering Christianity just like in the West from its very inception, from the very inception of the faith. It's not something that has come to it through the West or through Europeans or something like that. It's something concurrent with what is going on in the West. i.e. Christianity is expanding both westwards and eastwards. So I would like to, you know, keep that, for us to keep that in mind. It's not a self-contained thing with, you know, often we just think of the work of St. Paul and we just focus on that, and this is going to be the Christian world. Yes, but remember, Jesus had other disciples as well. And earlier he had sent out the 72 before that. So these people were scattering throughout the known world. And when John read that passage, what I would like to suggest to you is this: China is part of that known world. It's not a, you know, a land of mythology and so forth.
I think that really challenges both us in the West on two different fronts. One, we talked about before, just our, you know, maybe it's just the detritus of how high school classes are taught. You know, we think of the Roman Empire being this very insular thing, right? There's that challenge that, oh, there was this much more fluid interaction. But then there's the other one. Very often in at least Catholic history, the narrative is always through the Roman Empire and then through, you know, the early medieval area in Western Europe. And that's where the whole story takes place. And I think this reality is blowing our minds on both fronts.
Yes, exactly. Now, we haven't looked at Christianity in Central Asia and Persia and India yet, because all of this stuff is going on there too. But our focus has to be in China for now, otherwise we'd be all over the place. But this ferment of Christianity, the faith, is spreading like wildfire in the East. So Central Asia, you know, that where the river Oxus is flowing, as we looked at earlier, there's going to be monasteries and churches right there. And we're finding them now, actually. The most recent one was found, I think, 2012 or something. Because this area, strangely enough, has not been studied. Especially studying for Christian presence. You know, maybe some other time we can look at the Christianity along the Oxus. That would make a very interesting topic. So Persia, just to set the context, I guess we should do that. Persia, Central Asia, is heavily Christianized very early on, and we can look at that later, some other time. And it's from these areas. So when I mentioned, you know, Mar Sergis, the first known missionary into China, he's coming out of Persia. So he is a Persian, probably. It could, you know, we don't know his ethnicity, but certainly Syrian. And he is traveling east because this is the known world for them as well. So they have connections with the Roman world, and they also have connection with the Eastern world. And so the Eastern is very dynamic that way, the Eastern world, I should say. It's communicating with everybody. So when Mar Sergis goes to China, he is, you know, he's doing what has been done all the time. And this is where another important, I think, aspect of our story comes in. And this is the development of the what we know as the Silk Road, which is what John has just shown us on our map, you know, with all the camels going around.
Convenient with the camels, though. They have to go on the camels.
Yeah. So as you can see through the map, you know, people are traveling and making their way. Now, the interesting thing is that this road was ancient, but it was, permanently established, or we might say paved or whatever it could be, by a very important Chinese general by the name of Pan Chao. And he does this sometime in, I think, 94 AD. He's dead by about 102 AD. But by 94 AD, he has established what we will call the Silk Road, i.e. that permanent highway linking China with the West, with all of the West.
Dr. Ross, as we envision the Silk Road, which is so influential in East-West communication, ought we to think it as, you know, almost a single road, or is it appropriate more to think of it as something like the American Underground Railroad, which is a series of trade routes going, or a series of routes going in a general direction? What would you say is more accurate?
I would think of it, think of the road as a river with all little streams, you know, that come and flow into it. So all those little streams are the little, you know, passages, you know, paths, roads, other streets, you know, other passages and ways that people have made in order to travel. But there is a very succinct, you know, highway, i.e. it's a visible road as such, paved and looked after, because when Pan Chao makes this road, he also establishes way stations, i.e. resting places, highway, you know, inns. So it's basically, you know, inns, I think it were every 20 miles or 30 miles, I'm not sure offhand quickly, but there were, you know, stopping areas or caravanserais, as we will later on know them. These stopping stations are where people can rest and animals can feed and there's, you know, water and food and all that sort of thing. So there are restaurants set up along the way. So it's both. It's more, you know, it's like, you know, ways and passages and streets and roads, but there is also a main passageway, a main river into which all of these flow. And that river and that main road is maintained through imperial edict, the Chinese imperial edict, you know, through, they spend money maintaining the road, looking after it and repaving it and, you know, looking after the way stations, the resting stations, or the inns, as we might call them, along the way. So it's not a haphazard thing at all. It's a very structured thing. When we talk about the Silk Road, we're not just talking about, oh, we just kind of head, you know, west or east and keep walking that way. It's actually a specific passage, a road that you walk on, that you take, and it's well maintained. And it's going to be well maintained well into, probably the, 17th, 18th century. It's only then that it begins to fall apart and, other things happen.
Excellent. So I think, Dr. Das, what I'd like to do now is actually read a snippet from an article about the Christmas celebration in Tibet. Would that be a good place to go?
Sure, we could do that, yes.
Okay, excellent. So one of the happy things that have come of 2020 is the JSTOR people have allowed for more any old Tom, Dick, and Harry to pull articles off of them. So we make hay while the sun shines. All right. So this is an article entitled, I'm just going to read the first paragraph here, but there's so much to unpack. So a Tibetan Catholic Christmas in China, ethnic identity and encounters with ritual and revitalization. This article explores the annual observance of Christmas, the biggest festival of the year in a Tibetan Catholic village in southwest China. I provide a short history of Catholicism in the Sino-Tibetan borderlands. And by the way, Dr. Das, is it appropriate that, you know, we have our Bible translation that uses Sayin? You had mentioned a similar word. Would that be the origin of our modern prefix, Sino?
Yes. That is, Sinology, which is the study of China. Yes.
Great. The borderlands and explore the annual quote-unquote performance of Christmas by villagers. Please note, viewers, that our first article is from a tourist website. Very important. The author framed the syncretism of the Tibetan Christmas festival itself, a mix of Catholic ritual and Tibetan influences, against other ethnographic observations of Christmas. A second topic addressed is the influx of both Chinese and foreign tourists and academics who visit the village to observe and take part in the festival. In exploring the issue, I examine the relationship between these visitors and local Tibetan villagers during the festival. I suggest this plays into a larger move by Catholic Tibetans in the region to utilize the state development and transformation of the region as quote unquote Shangri-La to aid in promoting and developing their own unique identity as Tibetan Catholics. All right. So Dr. Das, I think a good place to move from here would be perhaps the interaction initially or in later history of Catholic culture and Catholic belief with the local indigenous culture.
Right. Now, when we get into these kinds of anthropological studies, we have to be very careful because unfortunately, a lot of these anthropologists have very little understanding of history. And so their assumptions are ahistorical, which can be good or bad, mostly bad, I think. Why I say that is because Tibet is not a stranger to Christianity either. Very quickly, we can, look at the history of Tibet, Christianity in Tibet, which goes back to the year 690 AD. And that is when we know that the very first churches were established and monasteries were established, Christian monasteries, I should say, were established, because there are Buddhist ones too, were established in this area. So we're looking at about 1300 some years of Christianity. So when we say, oh, there's one little Catholic church in Tibet, well, that one little church, of course, it's good that it's there, but it's not, it's a remnant as opposed to something new and something Western. It's a remnant of what was there before, which was great, which was amazing, which was expansive. And the development of Lamaism and Buddhism is much recent in Tibetan history than Christianity. From about 690, we can start looking at and tracing various, interactions and establishment of Christianity. And this is, of course, going to be done by missionaries out of Persia, out of modern-day Iran, Christian missionaries out of there, moving eastward into these areas. Now, the Christianity that they're bringing, we should, talk about that too. Is what we normally call Nestorian. And this has been given a very bad name, by people who should know better. Often we think of Nestorians as heretics, but that is simply wrong. They were not heretics. That's a misunderstanding and a misreading of Christian history. I don't know, do you want to briefly talk about the Nestorians, John, or?
I think that topic we ought to save for our next episode in order to give ourselves proper elbow room to get into it.
Sure. Okay. So what is it going on is that we don't have this division. Let's very briefly look at that. We don't really have this division of Catholic and non-Catholic Christianity right now. That is going to come much later on,
Right now being 6th-7th century?
Exactly, when this all is happening. So that schism comes, in 1053 or something, we'll talk about that at some other time, the Great Schism, or the split. But at this time, it's still unity we're talking about. There's a unification. No one's questioning the Christians in the East as somehow questionable. And saying we're better, we're the real Christians, they're not Christians. So that consciousness doesn't exist. When we're talking about, Christianity, we're talking about a faith that is still essentially unified. There isn't that much debate. Yes, there are disagreements, as Nestorians, are going to be doing later on, and we'll talk about that in a minute or later. But there's not going to be this consciousness of us and them that is going to be developing later on, which is going to isolate these communities, unfortunately. This is the tragedy of Christianity, of world Christianity, this isolation, self-imposed isolation of the faith geographically. And it's going to devastate the Christians in the East, as we will look at it later, as to why they disappeared largely. And of course, what happened to them in the West as well.
Excellent. Dr. Doss, if I can ask you off the cuff in our closing minutes here, what is your thought of the, one, are you familiar with it? And then if so, what is your thought of the text, The Lost History of Christianity from, I think it was about 15 years ago. Are you familiar with that book?
I haven't read it. So if you can familiarize with me, I don't know it at all. So.
Okay. Well, that author, he gets into this, indeed, the title works very well for our subject. This whole part of the church we think is we either think doesn't exist, or we think that after Chalcedon, you know, drifted into heresy. And that's an interesting topic altogether, that the development of the us versus them. I know the other day I had a discussion with someone, you know, about liturgy and public and private prayer. And it occurred to me halfway through the discussion that we were using very modern terminology for, you know, for this older reality of prayer. We were talking about, you know, liturgical traditions. And I thought how inappropriate, just in my mind, that we were using this kind of 19th century demarcation of things, trying to impose it on the 13th or 12th century, what we were talking about.
This is the biggest problem, is that we're so imprisoned by 19th century terminology and mindsets, 18th century as well, 18th, 19th centuries. You know, we really need to get away from, you know, Mr. Hume and company and all the rest of them that come after. Religions do not work this way, as David Hume assumes they do. They do not work this way. And especially Christianity. Christianity is not a bunch of, you know, pagan myths cobbled together to make it sound, you know, Christian and all of that, that we all, especially in Christmas time, all that comes out, you know, oh, the pagan roots of Christianity, I'm sorry, of Christmas and all of that.
No, Sol Invictus.
Oh, yes, and Christmas tree, right? Christmas tree is pagan, German, you know, some, yeah. No, it isn't. It was known as the paradise tree, which means it's part of the whole story of Adam and Eve. And this is why the early medieval church had Christmas trees. It was a reminder of the original sin and Christ's redemption. So there was a, you know, anyway, we won't get into that.
Adam and Eve's feast day, by the way, being the 24th of December.
Exactly. Thank you. Yes, exactly. But we'll talk about that some other time. So, you know, this is the problem. There's an 18th, 19th century mindset we still have, and we haven't gotten away from this mode of thinking, you know, and it's unfortunate that it becomes normal to say, oh, you know, Christianity just adopted all these things from all over the place. And it's what we'll talk about when we talk about Buddhism and Christianity, because the two in the East are now going to be combating or existing together. And what's going to happen in this area with them? And we will see, it's the dominant religion is Christianity, which is going to influence a lot of stuff in Buddhism. And of course, later on in Hinduism as well, but that's some other topic. So it's a great point you make. Unfortunately, we're still prisoners of that mindset, you know, of the 1700s and the 1800s. And we really need to work hard to get beyond these things. And because those are not good mindsets to have, because they lead us astray all the time, as they led those people astray into all kinds of problems, like the French Revolution, et cetera, you know, and the Russian Revolution and so forth. We have to be very careful with the way we think and how we use the paradigms we have in our heads to explain the world and the past. Because often those paradigms or those structures of explanation are wrong and are misguided. And therefore they misguide us and lead us into falsehoods and not the truth.
Excellent. So we'll leave it there. And when we come back for episode 20, we're going to start off with a treatment of Nestorianism, so-called, and the split and the isolation that happens. And then I think, Dr. Dasa, what do you think about merging into that very topic you bring up about the Buddhist and Christian interaction in Tibet?
Let's do that. And China as well. Let's do that. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. As we wind up in these closing minutes, the clock itself being a great artifact from the 18th century, or at least the attention we pay to it in the 19th. As we wind up, Dr. Das, tell us about the postul for this merry month of December, and what are some articles we ought to take our eyeballs to?
Oh, it's actually great stuff there. You've written another great piece. Actually, you've wrapped up your trilogy. Of We the People. So I would really highly recommend people, We the People, go over there and take a look at that great article that you've written. So I would highly recommend that. We have some more great interviews, a really interesting discussion of what the reality of the French Revolution was, the great slaughter of Christians during the French Revolution, because it was a profoundly anti-Christian movement as opposed to anything else. So it had very little to do with life, you know, liberty, brotherhood, and all that sort of thing. It was actually a very profoundly anti-Christian and a very violent anti-Christian movement. This is a very great article that looks at the slaughter that happened of Christians in the Vendée region of France. Terrible stuff. Those wounds are still around. People still haven't recovered. So France never really recovered from the violence of the French Revolution to this day. There's some very interesting articles that people should take a look at.
Excellent. And then concerning the school that Dr. Das and I run, Apostasis and Institute for the Humanities, that door is closing on old man time for 2020, but we're still taking students for the spring semester, which begins the 11th of January, and you may find out the various courses that we offer, Rome 1, Rome 2, Latin 1, 2, 3, each of these designations being a semester proper, Introduction to Historiography, Introduction to Pedagogy, and I'm sure I'm missing some Dante, Introduction to Dante and all that. You may go for all of that and for a look at the school in general to apostasisinstitute.wordpress.com to find out about that. And for any show tips, comments, and so forth, please write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. Dr. Das, thank you so much for your time here.
It was a pleasure, John, always. Take care.